Here you go, Dan.
Flowers, food, a ribbon shirt for me. What's going on?
April 10th is National Siblings Day, and you're my brother, my podcast brother. We've been doing this podcast for a few years now, and it's time that I just say it. Your family.
Oh, thanks, man. I didn't get you anything, though.
It's okay. It's okay.
No, seriously, I know Indigenous people recognize non-Indigenous peoples as family through things like ceremony and treaty, but I didn't realize it could be adopted via podcast, too. Reconciliation is so cool.
Here you go.
What is this? A list like eggs, milk, cheese?
Yeah, stop by Superstore on your way home.
Wait a minute.
Also, when you get home, make sure to fix that light on the porch. And there are several fence boards that need to be replaced. You do that. I'll do the dishes, vacuum. I'll have dinner ready too.
Oh, hey, wait a minute.
So don't forget, we are painting the house this weekend, so cancel your plans.
Again, I can't do any of this. I have a house, kids, a family, and Saturday night is date night with my wife.
It's okay. I phoned her and told her you're busy. By the way, we need to talk about some of the things you waste your money on.
I'm not sure I like this.
Truth before reconciliation, Dan.
The Winnipeg Free Press proudly presents, in partnership with CJNU 93.7 FM, Negan and the Lone Ranger. Here are your hosts, Negan Sinclair and Dan the Lone Ranger Lett.
Welcome, everybody, to a new episode of Negan and the Lone Ranger. My name is Dan Sinclair. Apparently now I'm...
thank God, it's time. It's time that you fix that. And yeah, not only do you fix that, but that you are a better person, I can tell now.
Yes, I'd like to thank my brother, Negan, for that bit of funny this morning. And the truth is that in an email exchange or a text exchange, he came out with this line that both myself and our producer Adam thought was really great. He said, "Truth before reconciliation," and we both agreed that that was a really great line. So you reversed engineered an entire skit based on the one great line that you've come out with this season.
Wish I could take credit for that line, but that's a pretty popular line in what we call Indigenous Twitter. That's usually a pretty popular line that most people use, especially when it comes to people jumping to actions before they think.
Well, you know, it's resonating with me so much so that the only promised as yet not materialized Negan and the Lone Ranger t-shirts that we keep talking about, like we had talked before about how we would put the podcast logo on the front, and then on the back it would say no comma it's not racist, and
or something about irony.
Something about irony. And but now I'm willing to admit that the back of the t-shirt should say truth before reconciliation. I think that, you know,
because with a little trademark on the corner.
Yeah. If nothing else, we do speak truth before reconciliation and to power. Yes, that's what we do.
Well, if they come on the podcast, usually.
If they come on the podcast. My neck hurts. Did I tell you that my neck hurts?
Is it whiplash? Is it you're spinning around? Is because you can't believe that the we're either on or off, or are we on this roller coaster still of tariffs? Who knows what's going on?
Great way to steal my punchline. You know, like it's, I mean, I had you all set up for a punchline.
I saw it coming, and I think everyone else did too.
Yeah. Okay. Trump tariff whiplash that's another copyrighted term. I'm going to, you know, get to the patent office. It's Friday morning when we're recording this part of the podcast, and just a sec, let me click. I'm just calling up the New York Times.
This is in real time, folks. Like,
this is
the thing about where we're at is you have to be watching the news literally hour by hour to see A, if the tariffs are on, and B, who bought the stocks when they were the cheapest. And the latest is Republican senators and House of Representatives magically just fluked out and now have made billions of dollars by buying the stock at the cheapest. Trump changes and course, and boom, the stock market comes back. And when it all comes out in the wash, You will find that a lot of people made billions of dollars in this debacle that's taking place in the South.
Yeah, it all seems to be set up, quite frankly, for profiteers to take advantage. The news this morning, as I'm trying to wipe the sleep out of my eyes, is that China has raised tariffs on U.S. imports to 125%, matching the U.S. levy. What that means is that the oven mitts and that the clothes steamer that you buy on Amazon are now going to cost about $100,000. So,
Will anyone ever drive cars again after this? That's the big question, I think, because the cars, it seems, will be tariffed 28 times before they are created as they cross the border, as the pieces, the building blocks of cars cross the border and their tariffs each time. It just seems like a car will be out of the reach of most people, except for those who are millionaires. And on top of that, I wonder about what is security going to look like in all of this when we have this massive meltdown between the United States and Canada. We see the only country that's not tariffed, apparently, that will have money out at the end of this will be Russia.
It's funny how somehow they don't seem to be affected by what's going on. I don't want to read too much into that unless it's
Oh, I'll
except for
read
the
into
obvious. Yeah, no, for sure. It's
Now,
crazy.
it's pretty ironic that islands predominantly inhabited by penguins are tariffed. Ukraine is tariffed. Pretty much everyone that is a manufacturer of cheap goods in the United States is tariffed, but not Russia.
Meanwhile, back in Canada, there's an election going on. The first 2 weeks of the election were incredibly fascinating, based largely on the completely improbable surge in support for the Liberals. And now we've kind of settled. We've settled into the Liberals appear to be leading just outside the margin of error of most polls, and I think the correct me if I'm wrong, and I don't want to steal the thunder of our extra special guest today, Eric Grenier from The Rit, but I wonder if the conservatives think that there's a bunch of people, like there's support to be had by cultivating votes from people who don't respond to polls, the on the far right of the spectrum, and that they kind of expect these people to show up in force on election day. And prove the polls all wrong. I don't know.
It would certainly suggest some of the combativeness with media, which plays really well with the base. Locking media, locking them in little pens during the press conferences for Poilievre, refusing questions other than selected media members, refusing follow-up questions, refusing media on the plane. That whole narrative really plays well into those who already feel quite disenfranchised by the system. And then it also plays really well into those who might not always watch major media platforms. And so the challenge is that we've got a party who is competitive in this election that is so driven by those who have historically or may not even participate in the election. It's created a very anomalous, weird
Yeah, I
situation.
don't know. I even when the Liberals were surging in some polls to double-digit leads over the Conservatives, I expect the result on election night to be much, much closer than the polls. And I think there's even a possibility that in the last 2 weeks of the campaign, we may see. I think we've already seen a modest narrowing.
Do you think that, I mean, okay, so what you saw is you're starting to see some two very distinct Trumpian tactics being used by the conservatives. We talk a little bit about this with our feature guest, but I want to ask you a big question here that we didn't talk to our feature guest about, but we see the kind of control of media or the combativeness with media. And then second is an obsession with crowd size and say in a sort of announcement of forget about the polls, look at the crowd size. Both of those are very Trump playbook tactics. Do you think that there's a possibility that we might see a this election was rigged, I don't believe the results, and all of this has created a farce of the system. And we won't see a January 6th kind of rise up. But I think that the poll this week, which suggests that a number of polls have been sort of looking at Western alienation, and the main poll that came out said that if the Liberals are elected, approximately 1 in 3, 1 in 4 people in Saskatchewan and Alberta will want to secede, or movements to want to secede. We do talk a little bit about this with our featured guest, but do you think that there is a potential of Pierre Poilievre, or if in the case of a loss, maybe a close loss, of saying that this election was rigged, I don't believe the results, would we see a full Trump
I think
playbook?
it's always a possibility. I think to this point that the Tory central campaign has been very careful not to take the bait when they're asked anything, a question in a news conference or through comms channels. For example, they publicly the campaign disavowed some of their candidates that were saying that the polls were part of foreign interference in the election, that the poll results are not a true reflection of what's going on in the country. This is election meddling, and that the Conservative campaign was very quick to disavow those comments. The crowd size thing, is so weird. It is true that you cannot ignore like a huge turnout for a candidate. If Mark Carney or Pierre Poilievre is showing up to an event and there is like a really big crowd, I mean that's an engaged party base. That it's not maybe a scientific metric of support, but it is a gauge of support a little bit. I think I saw the exchange between the Globe and Mail reporter and Pierre Poilievre on the, look at the size of the crowds and, well, you were there. And it was, yeah, like, I mean, to me, I think he was baited into that a little bit. But it's also like, don't talk about the crowd size. Who cares?
It is a almost direct, I mean, they've worked fairly hard to pivot the campaign, the Conservatives, and the results are showing. I mean, most polls have shown Poilievre at least 2 to 3 points increased in being seen as a favorable person for Prime Minister. Now, not, these aren't huge numbers we're talking about here, going from 25 to 28, when Mike Carney is at 45 to 48, is a very different a way that you're seen as a potential prime minister in waiting. So Poilievre has a lot of work to do to be able to be seen as sort of an adult in the room when it comes to Donald Trump. But they have pivoted the campaign. They've taken a much more aggressive approach. Poilievre famously this week said, "If I was prime minister, the tariffs would end on day one." How he does that is not fairly discern, but he said, "I will make sure this happens. I will take a combative role with Donald Trump." But then there's all these Trumpian tactics which seem to be emerging, and I guess the point is he being baited, meaning that he's not aware, or perhaps it's happening organically, or is it that there's a playbook here of combativeness with the media, obsession with crowd size, really foister a whole lot of attention on the disenfranchised and the marginalized, and then perhaps even question the results of the election? Is there going to be that kind of move, even if it's not something perhaps that was even intended?
I think there's always a possibility that we repeat the results of the last two elections where the Liberals won minority governments but got fewer votes than the Conservatives. I don't think that delegitimizes the results, although my dogged friends in the electoral reform community who flood my inbox with emails every time I don't talk about them. The liberals tend to be more efficient in their votes. So what that means is they tend to be built to win a greater number of close ridings, where the conservatives have huge pluralities in the last two elections in a fewer number of ridings. So they got to figure out some way of doing that. And that's why, like, I raised the issue of Are the conservatives hoping for a surge in the silent minority, right? People who don't respond to polls, who maybe don't vote on a regular basis. Are they cultivating these people to show up? My concern is, for the conservatives, is if they do show up, they're going to show up in ridings where the Tories are already strong. Like, they need to find these people in ridings in Ontario and Atlantic Canada in particular.
There is one interesting trend in the conservative campaign, and it's interesting that we're talking so much about the conservative campaign, maybe because of the kind of baffling nature in which you go from a 20-point lead to now being 5 to 7 points down. And also, the point is that their vote didn't shift all that much. They're still a block of 35, 38 in that neighborhood, and yet it's not enough. Typically, probably would be enough. The interesting trend that I've been noticing or that I've been talking about this week is there was a very interesting picture that was put onto social media just a few days ago. Actually, probably under 48 hours ago, where Poilievre appeared in a meeting with Treaty 6 chiefs. For those of you that don't know where Treaty 6 is, we're talking about really conservative base there. But it is an area of the country in which Poilievre has been turning towards First Nations issues as one of his main platform issues, whereas the Liberals are not. The Liberals are not really talking about Indigenous issues. It's funny that we have this topsy-turvy election followed by yet another topsy-turvy moment of the Conservatives are talking far more about Indigenous peoples than the Liberals are. And of course, what's the Conservative platform? It's predominantly resource development. It's about offering credit and buying power to buy onto pipelines and projects and things like that. Anyways, so Poilievre appears with these Treaty 6 chiefs, typical meeting. Most chiefs meet with the different federal leaders, et cetera, et cetera. But he's wearing obviously a gift from, or maybe something that someone put on him, which is a pendant that has it looks like a feather at the bottom. He's been sort of surrounded by these chiefs. And he is very much, it looks like, an endorsing kind of picture,
Yeah.
even though it's not an endorsing picture. Indigenous Twitter, Indigenous social media went nuts. And many Indigenous peoples who feel uncomfortable at times with the past of Pierre Poilievre, especially recently with some of his defending of a candidate that has been defending sort of residential schools. It was like a sort of civil war created on social media. Should chiefs meet with Poilievre generally. And it's very interesting. It's created a very interesting situation, but also indicates to you that he is doing what you say, which seems to be appealing to those who might not otherwise participate in elections, or perhaps are feeling disenfranchised or being left out of the liberal conversation as liberals are focused far more on tariffs and Trump.
We've talked about pivoting campaigns. We're going to pivot the podcast now to our feature interview, which you handled on your own.
You know what I said? You know what I said? As I said, Dan, stay home. Stay home this week. You deserve it. You've worked hard. You've been a good, loyal relative, organizing guests, and in fact, you organize this one as well.
Well, I was going to say it's not like I wasn't involved in this.
I handled the reins this week. Ohio Silver. I headed in the direction, and let me tell you, we're talking like Peabody winning stuff here. This was probably the greatest interview we've ever done.
I'm not sure. Are we even eligible for Peabody's in Canada?
I think this would be we over we this interview is so good, it's going to supersede the genre.
Okay, Barbara Frum, kind of territory, like
Never before seen. And let me tell you, I will say that the first thing that Eric said when I was so happy to see him, I think I was just shocked that he showed up and that you organized it. I said, Eric, it's so good to see you. And he said, I've never been so warmly greeted on a podcast. So there you go.
Okay, sorry, I'm just a sec. I have to make mental note to talk to Eric to stop being so effusive. Like it's dude, like anyways. No, I it it sounds like it was a great interview. And so here is Nigan's. This is Nigan's first, I think this is your first solo
First
flight.
solo interview it is, and we talk about lots of really interesting things. Close races in Manitoba is where we pivot near the end, but when we start at the beginning, we talk about is the Carney support soft or real? Is it hardening? Is it something that's real? Is it a facade? And then, of course, we talk about crowd sizes, what we just talked a little bit about, but the pivoting conservative campaign. Bonjour. Welcome, everybody, to our feature interview with our good friend and now friend of the podcast. I don't know if you know, but you've become, when you appear multiple times, you become friend of the podcast, Eric Grenier from The Writ and co-host of the podcast, Les Chiffres, also The Numbers. Welcome, Eric.
Thank you very much. Is it like a Saturday Night Live thing if after five times I get a jacket?
There is talk of t-shirts. I'm not
Okay.
sure if these will ever materialize, but please send us your size. And we would be happy to give you a Neon and the Lone Ranger t-shirt. Although some people are fearful of wearing them, they think it's racist.
I'm not sure how I
We
feel.
offered
You
one.
tell me.
We had the Prime Minister on Trudeau on a short while ago, and we offered him a t-shirt. He said, "I'm not sure I'm going to wear that." And so we're very pleased to have you on. Thanks for coming back. And we're very pleased to talk about a couple things in we're going to talk a little bit about Manitoba politics, a little bit about numbers. We've reached the halfway point of the federal election campaign 2025, one of the fastest, arguably. I think it was the minimum amount of days that an election campaign can be run. So we reached the halfway point, and we're seeing really interesting things in the trending of polling that tend to stay similar, but you see these very interesting kind of perspectives of the same numbers. For instance, the Liberals tend to be holding a lead somewhere between 43-47%, and the Conservatives somewhere between 30, I'll say 36 and 39% in that neighborhood. Consistently in all the polls, you see the same numbers. You study polls for a living. How can two people, three people, newspapers, TV shows all see numbers differently? Like, for instance, some people are saying, this is shows that there's soft liberal support and the conservatives have room to gain. Is it just that people want to swing or spin narratives or?
I do think that tends to be part of it. One of the problems when a campaign starts to get pretty stable, as we've seen this campaign get, is that you have to make the numbers sound interesting. And sometimes they're not that interesting, right? In the poll tracker that I run for the CBC, it's an average of the polls, and it's really been shifting around 6 to 7 points for the last week and a half, if not for the last 2 weeks. So there really isn't that much movement in the polls. But if you are trying to make your polling sound a little bit more interesting, then you'll pay attention to some of the variations. And there's different kind of polling that is being done right now, because we have some polls that are those weekly polls that we hear from some of the big pollsters. They have deals with Canadian Press or the Globe and Mail, or not the Globe and Mail in this case, Global News, I mean, Ipsos, for example. And those are just these almost these signpost polls that are done once a week, and we get an idea of the trend line. And those are all showing pretty stable stuff. The other set of polls that we get are the daily trackers. There's three of them right now, so they're polling every single day, and they're doing rolling polls. So they combine the last 3 days of polling, then with a new day, they drop the old day, they add the new day. Those vary a lot more because they're being done all the time. They're not being done online. Online polls tend to be a bit more stable. So those give the impression of lots of movement, that things are up 2 points, things are down 1 point here. Look at all how exciting all of this is. But if you kind of flatten it out, they're not really showing all that much. There might be some days that are better for the liberals and some days are better for the conservatives. But if we flattened it out to look at the broader trend line, there's not that much going on. The liberals moved ahead by 5 to 7 points on average after about the first week, and then things have stayed there since that. I think that is pretty much what the polls are showing. But I mean, media does have to try to sell eyeballs and clicks and all that kind of stuff. And it's more interesting to give the perception that, oh, this is all, there's still lots of uncertainty and things are moving around, so you got to check back every single day.
Do you think that, I mean, obviously, I guess polling companies are kind of competitive. They want to get eyeballs on their poll versus this other poll. I was watching Power and Politics, a show that we're both on fairly regularly last night, and they were kind of applauding because I think what was an outlier poll now has come into concert with all the other polls. And I think it was Main Street that tended to be
It was
the
probably Abacus, actually, I think.
maybe abacus that tended to have the conservatives higher than almost anybody else. And of course, polling data is often influenced of who you're asking, where are you asking, what question are you asking, those kinds of things. And so it was interesting that now sort of pollsters are analyzing, talking to each other, maybe being a bit competitive with one another. Do you find that?
Oh, yes. Pollsters are among some of the most competitive people I've interacted with. They are very competitive with one another, and for good reason. I mean, their whole business is based on reputation, on how accurate their polling is on election day. And so the ones who are marginally closer than the others have a competitive advantage. So they want to be closer to the result than anybody else. That is one of the things that I think people don't think about a lot when they think about polls. They think that They always think that some pollsters in is a shill for one party or another, or that they're trying to push some sort of narrative. All they want to do is get as close as possible because it's good for business. And it's in a way the best kind of assurance that the pollsters are trying to do a good job is that if they don't do a good job, they lose money. I think that they are pretty competitive. One of the things that we've seen over the last little while is that there were two polling firms that were showing still a close race. They were showing that either the conservatives were ahead by a point or tied. This was Innovative Research Group and Abacus Data. But now we've seen that those two pollsters as well have started to show the 6-point lead for the liberals. Now, their data is probably just picking this up like everybody else, and there's a reason why we're all seeing the same numbers. But I think for people like me who watch it, I prefer to have the polls relatively all in the same place because I don't want to think that that I'm not understanding how the race is going because I look at the bulk of them. So all the polls now are showing a gap usually between anywhere from 3 to 10 points. That's where the polls are right now. When there was one poll showing that maybe the conservatives are actually ahead, it put a little kernel of doubt, into my mind. Now I don't feel as uncomfortable where things are. So that makes me feel better in the sense of trying to get an understanding of the numbers. I don't like it when it's possible for two completely different things to be true at the same time, because then you don't really know where the truth lies.
Isn't that what the conservatives are trying to do right now by saying, don't look at the polls, but look at how many people are at our gatherings? Isn't that what the, I mean, it's almost like a direct result reaction to what the polls are saying. They're saying, hey, don't worry about the polls, but we had 13,000 people in this facility the other day.
The fact that they can get that many people to attend a rally is impressive, right? These are huge things to pull off. They're not easy to do, but they're not representative samples of the population. And it sounds like such a nerdy thing to say, but like polls are done in a scientific way. There's a mathematical kind of formula behind it and theory that if you poll X amount of people, you should be able to get within 3 or 4 points of what the reality is. I mean, 100% of the people going to the conservative rallies are going to vote for the conservatives. It's not a representative sample of the population, right? I think that what they're doing with those rallies is one, they're trying to signal to their own supporters that things aren't going so bad. Look at how many people we can get. This isn't over. Go out and volunteer, donate, tell your friends, get people to vote. So I think it is meant as a good way to counteract the narrative in the polls. But they've also been effective in causing doubt. I've gotten many questions from journalists saying, can we trust the polls? Look at these rallies.
I mean, Donald Trump federal election tied, but yet keeps saying, oh, look at all these rallies, and then comes to election night and boom, he wins all the swing states, which said that there might be some argument in some questioning polls. But I mean, how do you feel about that when you hear it?
Well, the thing is, to me, those are so people think of the result of the US election and they think that it was more or less that the polls are 100% wrong. Because they said Harris had the better shot of winning, though which they didn't. Everybody was saying it was a toss-up, and Trump won. So it seems like it was a binary choice. Either the polls are right or they're wrong. But in reality, the polls are off by about 2.5 points. And those 2.5 points made all the difference. They meant that Trump could win in Wisconsin and Pennsylvania and Michigan and all those places. But 2.5 points is not a lot. And in a Canadian election, if the Liberals are up by 6 or 7 points, as we see right now, if they're up instead by 4.5 points or 3.5 points, they still win the election. And they still win it pretty handily. They won the last two elections despite losing the vote by over a point. So when people think of the US election, they think of the result having been such a surprise. But the polls were actually not so bad that they would invalidate the kind of polling we see right now in Canada. Now, things might be by if we get to election day and it's a tied race, then okay, maybe the polls could be off by enough that the conservatives end up winning. But in the race that we're in right now, which is a pretty big liberal lead, it's extremely unlikely the polls would be off enough that, in fact, the conservatives would win instead of the liberals.
Yeah, I can tell you that watching you take this apart or pick this apart or explain it has been so helpful for me, because one of the things that really influenced me that you said recently was if they're statistically tied, that's a liberal victory because of the efficiency of the liberal vote. The conservatives would need to be 2 to 3 points ahead for it to be a conservative victory or looking like a conservative victory. So a 6-point lead for the liberals really suggests almost like, I wouldn't call it a landslide, but I would call it a very significant majority.
Yeah, well, my projections right now have them winning almost 200 seats, or actually at 200 seats, which the party's never done before, which again makes me uncomfortable. I don't like projecting things that seem incredible or
Making
unbelievable,
news,
right?
making news.
Yeah, but that's it. But no, with the kind of leads we see, because they're ahead by about 10 points in Ontario, they're ahead by 20 points in Quebec, they're ahead by 20 or 30 in Atlantic Canada, they're even ahead in British Columbia by a decent margin. You put that all together. When a lot of those seats are coming from the NDP and the Bloc, there's not much the Conservatives can do about that. That's one of the issues that the Conservatives face, is that right now they're at 37% in our average. And as you mentioned, some polls have them as high as 40. The lowest you usually see is now 36, something like that. Those are the exact same numbers that Stephen Harper used to win three elections. He had 36% of the vote in 2006. He had about 38, 39 in 2008, and he had just under 40 in 2011. But because the NDP and the Bloc vote has dropped so much, and it has all gone to the Liberals, that the numbers the Conservatives are putting up aren't good enough. And that also comes to the rallies. If, let's say, the Liberals had never recovered, they were still at 20%, they were fighting with the NDP for second spot, and the Conservatives were at 38%, on track for a huge majority government, putting together these rallies. We'd say, look how great these rallies are, the sign of the momentum the Conservatives have. But they're still at the same 37, 38% of the vote that they would have had in that scenario. The only difference now is that it isn't enough, or as it would have been before. So it's that context that I think people have difficulty with, that it's the idea that there's this pool of rally goers that everybody is trying to get, and the Conservatives are getting all of the rally goers, which means they must be winning the election. That's not how it works.
Are you prepared, and let's make some news here, are you prepared to call this an unprecedented election? And here's what I mean by that is we're seeing what would traditionally be a number that the conservatives could win with now looking like they're going to lose, or if the election was held today, certainly they would be in a position in which the Liberals would win an unprecedented amount of seats. Notice I keep using the word unprecedented. The NDP bottoming out, it appears, seems to be unprecedented. We are polling in Manitoba in the Free Press that there is an unprecedented leap in support for Liberals, mostly due to Trump, but we would also say largely in part because perhaps Pierre Poilievre may not be the favorable prime minister candidate that for a lot of people. I mean, 44% is what we projected, or what we have said that liberal support has increased in federal ridings throughout the province. That is a crazy amount of increase of support all at once. Are you prepared to use the word unprecedented? You're not that older than me, or maybe you're, I think you're probably younger actually. But we're about
Don't
the
let the
same
hair
age.
fool you.
We're about the same age. I always hear these terms unprecedented. This is the most important election in history. Is this the most important election in history? Is this unprecedented? Is this things we've never seen before?
When it comes to whether it's the most important, I'll leave that up to the pundits and the historians and this kind of thing. I can't comment on that, but I think this is an unprecedented election. I think so, because the Conservatives started this campaign, or at least started this election year, with a 25-point lead against a 10-year-old government who had a very unpopular prime minister. They should have won this election. Now they could end up losing by 5 points, let's say. So there we're talking about a 30-point swing in a matter of months for a government seeking its fourth term with a new leader that, by all accounts, is not an electric kind of figure, right? The fact that it could go from such a obvious and almost inevitable conservative victory to such a big potential win for the Liberals is just incredible. The fact that this would, if the Liberals pull this off, let's say they get 200 seats, 44% of the vote, which is where we have them projected right now. They've never won 200 seats. And the last time they were in the 40s, well above 40%, was in like 1980, or some of the elections with Pierre Trudeau. And back then, it's because 70% of the vote in Quebec went to the Liberals, which isn't the case now. It's just an incredible change of fortunes, which I did not predict. I will say that fully at the beginning, that I thought that at the beginning of the year, the Conservatives were going to win this election. It was going to be a huge win. The only question was, could the Liberals survive? And now we're talking about, could the NDP survive? And what happens if the Conservatives lose a third consecutive election with the same amount of seats, or a fourth consecutive election? It is an unprecedented election. And I think it's just because of, really, to be frank about it, the unprecedented nature of the threat we face from the United States.
Yeah. And we just before we came on the podcast, we were talking about there is kind of a revitalized patriotism in the circles that I run in, which are, I would even say it's a newfound patriotism amongst Indigenous peoples, which at times to me, these are people that I often march with, people that back in my activist days were, some of them were, you know, burning the Canadian flag. And here we are now in positions in which they're now defending the nation versus this kind of ongoing threat of Donald Trump. And what you pointed out, which is that there is this kind of, would you call it revitalized or reborn or maybe new patriotism in even areas that were staunch Bloc Québécois supporters. That's interesting. So there is a kind of unprecedentedness that we're seeing in this election that harkens back to a kind of new wave. We might call it in the future a new wave of Canadian politics and patriotism coming out of this moment.
Yeah, obviously, you know, the situation for Indigenous peoples and Quebecers are very different. But we've seen a drop in support for sovereignty, independence in Quebec of 10 points, just all of a sudden, as a result of Donald Trump. It was trending upwards towards the high 30s, around 40%. And then all of a sudden, the same polling firms were putting it down to 27, 29%. And the fact that we have the Liberals now leading in Quebec, and in some polls approaching 50%, with a leader who does not speak French very well, and who doesn't seem to be
the thing that blows me away.
Like, it does.
I'm so looking to what the debates are going to happen, and that we do a French language debate, and I wonder what Quebecers will think of Mark Carney, because his French is not his strength.
No, but I think what we've seen is that it doesn't matter. We've seen polls asking, like, do you think Mark Carney's French is good enough in Quebec? And you'll get a plurality of people saying no. But the thing is that you're always graded on a curve in Quebec when it comes to the French language. If you're an Anglophone who is trying, you get lots of points. If you're someone who claims to be a Quebecer, claims to be in touch with the province, and you don't speak French that well, I don't think you get graded as well. Justin Trudeau was always criticized for his French in some circles in Quebec because they didn't think it was up to par for what it should be as a Quebecer. But for Mark Carney, French is far worse, and he's getting a lot more of a pass because people kind of expect that if you're an Anglophone, you're not going to speak French that well, and so it's okay. And he's not there to speak French. He's there to deal with Donald Trump and all this kind of stuff. So I'm very curious to see what happens in the debate as well, but I'm not sure if it's going to matter that much, because I think it might already be baked in that a lot of Quebecers expect his French to be awful. So if he at least is okay, he'll surpass expectations. It's a little bit like that famous quote from, I think it was Corey Tanaka ahead of the 2015 leaders debate, where he said that Trudeau would win if he showed up with his pants on. For Mark Carney, I think he just needs to be able to, you know, say Frère Jacques or something like that, and he can get through the debate.
Okay, that's making news right there. You better be careful throwing around things like that. Two big questions. I want to talk about what has often been called soft support for particularly Mark Carney, and whether that's true or not. And then, you know, in terms of the likability of him as prime minister, and we see a recent Nanos poll that that rises or perhaps suggests that there is a kind of favorability. The Conservatives have completely shifted their campaign towards a more dealing with Trump-like nature versus going through the old hits, the old carbon tax, Carney, the old, we are the ones that are the new fresh face of the Canadian politics. And then we'll get to Manitoba politics right after that. But first question is, are we to believe that Carney, as Canadians get to know Carney more, there is a suggestion with Nanos, a poll that came out that said that Carney's likability or presentability as a prime minister, that he is dropping somewhat. 3% conservative leader Pierre Poilievre has increased slightly, 2%. So it seems to be a trade-off that Canadians are getting to know Carney, maybe looking, seeing Poilievre dealing more with Trump. Do you think that's true? There is some soft support for Carney?
I'm not sure. We've seen a number of polls that it goes a bit, little bit back to what we said at the beginning. Some polls are showing that maybe Carney's numbers are getting a bit closer to Poilievre's. Others are showing the opposite. So I'm not sure if we have a clear indication of whether the more Canadians see Carney, the less they like him. An Abacus data poll that just came out this week had his positive ratings continuing to grow, and his negatives actually went down. So I think it depends on kind of how you're asking the question and how you're looking at it. But in terms of the soft support, I think we're starting to see that that is firming up. Because at the beginning of the campaign, you asked liberals, how committed are you to voting for the Liberal Party? It was a lot lower than the Conservatives. We're seeing that that gap is not as big as it used to be. But I'm not sure what to read into it that much, because Conservative voters are very committed to voting for the Conservative Party, in part because they don't see any other options. When you ask Conservative voters, who is your second choice? The top second choice is always nobody else. So if you're a voter who votes for the Conservative Party, you probably don't feel like you have that many other options, so you're going to be very deeply committed to that one option. For liberals, they just got a whole bunch of new Democrats coming to their side. They just got some bloc voters. They might still be a little bit on the fence, but those other parties would have to give them a reason to go back. The Bloc, I think, has more of an opportunity to do that. They have the French language debate. Yves-François Blanchet is effective in those settings. The NDP, I don't know. They seem to just be losing steam and losing purpose in this election, and I think that they have a much harder hill to climb to get their voters back. So I do think that the Conservative vote, the Conservative floor, is far higher and it's far firmer than the Liberal. But the Liberal ceiling is right now, and this is a shift. We didn't see this earlier in the year. Their ceiling is higher than the Conservatives. More people would consider voting for them than for the Conservative Party.
Yeah, I've said a few times that one of the real unprecedented, but perhaps surprising or maybe tragic stories of this election is that Jagmeet Singh is arguably one of the most successful NDP leaders of all time, got the most amount of things done. Even I would say more than Jack Layton got. More policies, pharmacare, $10 daycare. I mean, in many ways, the NDP were a significant portion of why the Liberals were interested, moved towards. I guess Liberals might argue with me a bit on that, but Jagmeet Singh has a track record, which is unlike many NDP federal leaders, and he's probably going to be punished for it, or he's not going to get rewarded for it, is what I mean.
I think in terms of legislative accomplishments, you can probably put Jagmeet Singh up there with Tommy Douglas and David Lewis, who did a lot with the Trudeau government in the 70s. But in terms of the electoral outcome, he's not up there with Broadbent or Layton or those. Well, those two would be the top two. I think that what it is that the NDP has struggled, I think, with its positioning in the whole confidence and supply agreement. Not so much because I don't think people are don't like what they brought in, or that they're rewarding the Liberals for things that the NDP proposed. I think that issue, that the way they handled, particularly the breakup, it just wasn't very serious. First, they were going to defeat this government, and then they didn't at the first opportunity, and then they're back and forth and back and forth. And Jagmeet Singh, for all of his personal likability, sometimes struggles to answer a follow-up question, because sometimes the NDP's logic a lot of these things, it didn't really survive that second follow-up question. Pulling support for the government, cannot support this government. Will you defeat the government? Well, we're not saying that right now. It, I think that that kind of it sapped the NDP's kind of strength. But what was propping them up, I think, throughout this whole period was Justin Trudeau was so deeply disliked that Pierre Poilievre was seen as the far better option, and Jagmeet Singh was seen as a fine option when Justin Trudeau was there. But now that Justin Trudeau's gone, Mark Carney is there. Carney seems like the better option than Poilievre to a lot of voters, which is why he's now first. And for those other voters, especially in the context of Donald Trump, he seems a much better option than Jagmeet Singh. And I think that the NDP has just lost its reason to, it's almost its reason to exist in the current context. The NDP is not going to die or anything like that. Everybody always calls the death of a party every time they have a bad election. But I think in the current context, they just do not have a good reason for people to vote for them at this stage.
Which brings us to Manitoba. We've one of the things that we said most recently on the podcast a couple of weeks ago was the kind of survivability of the NDP will be found in Manitoba. In many ways, Manitoba is the kind of lifeboat. I think if the NDP are going to survive, they're going to find a significant amount of seats in Manitoba as that place in which they may or may not survive. And I think you could, on election night, you could look to Manitoba, and I think that will indicate where the NDP standing will be. There are some very safe NDP seats like Winnipeg Centre. It's very unlikely Leah Kazan's going to be defeated in that riding. And then, of course, there is some questionability whether in Elma Transcona, whether the kind of staunch NDP support for such a long period of time can be salted away by some Liberal supporters, which may open up the road for the Conservatives. But, in Winnipeg, there's not a lot of really tight competitive races, with the exception of Winnipeg West, where we see Marty Morantz and Doug Yolofsen going together for round three, I think now, or two, or whatever round we're in now, separated by just a few dozen votes in the last federal election. But we'll see. That's kind of very much a bellwether riding. There's a possibility that out there in Saint-Patel that Terry Duguid may be in for a fight, looking at some conservative support in that area. Is there any riding that you're looking at in Manitoba that is kind of curious, or that you think that there may be a fight worth watching that on election night would be a tipping point or something that people should look to?
What I always find interesting about talking with people who have that, that local kind of presence and knowledge is how different things are sometimes between the numbers and what people expect. So when I'm looking at the polls in Manitoba, I see that a lot of seats could change. Now, that's just based on the polling numbers. It's not based on the quality of the candidates or the demographics of the riding or anything like that. It's based on the polling numbers and the last results. So when I've been going through the numbers, and it's one of the reasons why I talked about sometimes feeling discomfort with the numbers of what the polls produce in terms of electoral outcomes. Winnipeg West to me looks like an obvious Liberal pickup. They almost won it last time, and if they're up in the polls, they should win it this time. The way that the NDP's vote has dropped so much makes me think Winnipeg Centre is a riding that could flip. The fact, that Elmwood Transcona was close in that by-election and the NDP's vote is far lower now suggests to me that the Conservatives could pick up Elmwood Transcona.
And the boundaries have changed on that riding too, which I
Yeah.
think has really shifted the power in that riding. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, even with some of the numbers I've seen, you would see look at like Kildonan and St. Paul as a potential kind of close riding. And I mean, you're probably gobsmacked to hear me say things like that.
I'm shocked that you would talk about that one, but I
And then there's the riding of the North Churchill Kwadnik-Askey. Again, with the NDP vote dropping so much, it should be a riding that should be in danger. When the NDP vote is dropping by half in places, like, how do you not lose a riding? That is what the polls suggest would happen. Now, voters tend to organize themselves in a more sensible fashion.
I mean, then
And
you
so
add in
some
what's the difference there? Quality of candidate, contextual situations that influence, let's say, 2 or 3 percentage points. Like that would be the kind of difference that I think we would bring to the table because we know it locally. Like immediately when you're talking about, let's say St. Boniface, for example, right? St. Boniface, long-standing riding held by Dan Vandel. He was kind of seen as the general after the passing of Jim Carr. He was kind of the general of Manitoba. He was the face of Liberal politics in Manitoba. The retirement and the rise of new candidates in Liberal, I think, has created kind of vulnerability in that seat, but I still think it's going to be still fairly strong Liberal riding. You would just see that as a fait accompli, right?
Yeah, with the kind of right now it's impossible with the numbers to see the Liberals losing anywhere, which is not going to happen. They will always end up losing one or two seats. There's a couple of ridings that buck the trend, but and I'm not even talking about Manitoba. I'm talking about Canada. When you're up 12 points from your last result, you shouldn't lose any seat, right? So for me, anything that was red last time should stay red this time, and anything that was close last time should flip over to the Liberals. The Conservative vote is held up, though. That is the one thing that is, especially in the prairies, that is the one thing that gives me some pause, that their vote hasn't dropped at all. So if they were in ridings where they were close to that 50% mark to begin with, it'll be hard for them to lose that seat. So like rural Manitoba obviously going to stay blue. But some of those other ridings, like their votes were in the, in Winnipeg West and in Kildonan and St. Paul, is reachable if we, especially if we see, like I said, those voters sorting themselves out. If the NDP voters in those ridings get behind the Liberals, if the Liberals in Elmwood Transcona get behind the NDP, seen as the strategic vote option, then then you could see that kind of thing happen. But it's just the NDP numbers are so incredibly bad. To the extent that I would not have expected, that it makes me think that any seats that they win, it's because of the person that was on the ballot.
Yeah, I would say strength of candidate, like the when you said Winnipeg Centre, it'd be up for grabs. It's just to me that's preposterous. I mean, the candidate that the Liberals are running in, I'm not complaining or me saying anything mean when I say that this is a generally a paper candidate who's being run in. I'm probably going to get some angry emails from that one, but I would say it's a young person from the sort of Manitoba Liberal Federal Caucus. They're very little political experience. I'm embarrassed to say I can't remember his name, just because in terms of that riding, which is right beside my neighborhood, it is everyone knows Leah Gazzan. Everybody will vote for Leah Gazzan. That there is no reason not to. She is a present in her constituency. She's very much like a Kevin Lamoureux. Like you would never question Kevin Lamoureux's support in Winnipeg North. Because he is just such a staunch pro constituency, not so worried about things that are happening in Ottawa, really involved with the community. So yeah, I'm kind of shocked at some of those numbers, but I guess it's strength of candidate, contextual issues, which brings me to Winnipeg North, Churchill Askey, Kiewit Askey. It is going to be an interesting riding. I mean, Nikki Ashton has been a long-serving, comes from the Ashton, Steve Ashton, long member of the Manitoba NDP, ran against Premier Canoe to be the leader of the NDP, provincial NDP, long-standing union connections with the Ashton family. There's been some, it's turning into a bit of an ugly fight up there. If you go to social media and you'll see there's a kind of lot of mudslinging, like the this recent challenge of Mark Carney's father as being an operator of a day school, a residential school, hit the Manitoba's north harder than it probably hit anywhere else in the country, because it is a riding with like 40% plus First Nations voters. And so it's the kind of riding where that issue matters. And the fact that Mark Carney took a few days to address that issue, I think, might have impacted some ways in which people saw Rebecca Chartrand, who's running for the federal Liberals. Second time around, the two of them are battling. It certainly shows that there is there's maybe ridings or issues that the federal Liberals, that the federal NDP may be facing that might not be in other ridings throughout the country.
Yeah, there's always that aspect that is hard to tease out from the polling, and especially Manitoba, because most of the polling we get, unfortunately, is combined with Saskatchewan, so we don't always have a good idea of what's happening in Manitoba itself. I know the polling that Probe Research does for the Free Press gives us that little pinpoint, but the last, I don't know, perhaps there's a more recent one, but the one that had the NDP at 9% in Winnipeg and in northern and rural Manitoba, kind of floored me, because if they were at 9%, there's not a surviving a new Democratic MP. So I would be curious to see where the numbers are right now. But yeah, I do think like Manitoba hasn't had that many close ridings in the last couple elections. Winnipeg West was a close one, or the old name for it, Charleswood, was kind of close. But apart from that, Liberals were pretty well ensconced where they won, the NDP pretty well ensconced where they did, and the Conservatives pretty dominant in where they did. I would be surprised if more than If not more than one seat swung this time. I'm going to put that on the table.
That's on the record. Well, I really,
Yeah.
I mean, A, I appreciate that you know so much about Manitoba. B, I appreciate that you're open to the idea that sometimes people in other parts of the country might not understand elements of the prairies. There are some kind of interesting things that happen I think that are different than Ontario, which is dominates so much of the discussion, federal election. But here's my last question to you, and maybe you can give me a bird's eye view. We debated this on our podcast in previous episodes. In the early stages of the campaign, all the federal leaders, sorry, not liberals, but all the federal leaders came to Manitoba first. Like, why is that? They didn't go to Saskatchewan first. They didn't go to Alberta first. I mean, obviously, for a whole bunch of reasons. I think maybe certain ridings or provinces are not always welcome. Like, you'd think they would go to Ontario, Quebec first, although, I mean, boom, all of them showed up in Manitoba in the span of 5 days, except for maybe the People's Party, except for obviously the Bloc. But we saw Jagmeet Singh, we saw Mark Carney, we saw Pierre Poilievre, we saw Elizabeth May. All in 5 days.
I guess my question would be, do they come back?
Yeah, that's what
That would be my
the
question.
Lone Ranger Dan Lett said. He said, this might
Yeah.
be checking the box exercise, and we're not all that special.
Well, I mean, I do think that Winnipeg is a real battleground. And as I mentioned, I see ridings where the conservatives are on defense and where they're on offense, where the liberals are on offense, probably not on defense. But where the NDP is on defense, as you mentioned, the NDP needs to keep its seats in Manitoba. And they have people to lean on, right? Wab Kinew is still the most popular premier in the country. The Manitoba NDP is doing amazingly well. How much of that vote can they keep orange, I guess? But we've seen it just, it's just been remarkable to see how you have in the four Western provinces where the provincial NDPs are all pretty strong, that the Liberals are doing really well in all of those provinces, and the federal NDP is not. So are we in a scenario where all of that provincial NDP vote, be it in BC, Alberta, Saskatchewan, Manitoba, is just going to the Liberals because they're seen as the alternative to the Conservatives, and then all of that vote will just go straight back to the NDP the next time the provinces vote? It's just an interesting development to see the Liberals at over 40% in BC, sometimes over 30 in Alberta. Sometimes even over Saskatchewan seems to be a bit more of a struggle for them, but sometimes at 30. And then in Manitoba, we've seen some polls where they were in the 40s, right? Or as you said, approaching that 50%. So it seems like the NDP should be able to do better in Manitoba, but if that vote just goes over to a strategic anti-conservative vote, then certainly the conservatives are in trouble, but the NDP will be in trouble too.
What certainly also makes you think about if there is liberal support that's coming from the NDP in these provinces, these prairie provinces, there is an equal and opposite vociferous hatred for the liberals from, and I say vociferous hatred. There was a poll that came out that said that, one in three, or I think it was maybe one in four, if the Liberals were to win federally, that there would be movement to be sovereign in Saskatchewan and Alberta, which of course I quickly reminded people that, it's the same conversation about Quebec sovereignty. You cannot just leave without talking to First Nations first. And when you decide to cancel the federal government in your province, the land reverts back to Indigenous peoples. And so the Crown is then expelled from the treaty situation. So you better start negotiating treaties there, Danielle Smith and Scott Moe. But that being said, do you believe those? Do you believe that sort of there is this staunch, hardcore anger against the Liberals that are is eternal, that will always stay there, that will never change?
I'll say first, as someone who was born in Quebec, the reality of sovereignty and independence is very complicated, and Quebecers have been debating it now for 60 years, and have gone back and forth on all those issues. And I don't think Albertans and people in Saskatchewan have gone to as much thought in terms of the detail and how complicated it would be. I don't know what to make of those kinds of things because I saw in the same polling that was done, you still had 13%, I think it was, in Manitoba, and I think it was 12% in Ontario, or I might be reversing those, who would also want to become independent. Now, do you find that there is an independence movement in Manitoba? A serious one?
Well, not a serious one, but I think that in rural Manitoba, there is a true blue, no liberal will ever come in my neighborhood kind of attitude that I think May at times be well earned. I mean, I think a lot of people, especially social conservatives, feel that the liberals are very so woke that they're never going to be recoverable, that there's certain issues involving maybe belief or sexuality or gender that just will never penetrate certain corners of Manitoba. So, I
I
mean,
think that Western, like Western grievances and regionalism, I think still exists very much. I don't think that that has gone away. I think the legacy of the National Energy Program and all these things still exists out in Western Canada. So it doesn't shock me when we see polls that have that kind of thing. But I just think that it is it's a kind of more of an emotional response rather than a actual response. That will a sovereignty movement erupt in Saskatchewan and Alberta if Carney is reelected? Would it make sense if the Liberals end up and the Liberals and the NDP combine for 40% in those provinces that that there's a huge rejection of those parties when they're elected in the rest of the country? I don't really I don't think it the thing is every time there's been a sovereignist party a separatist party on the ballot in Saskatchewan or Alberta they do very very poorly so I do think it's the difference between answering a poll being angry at the Liberal government versus an actual sovereignist movement I you know you talked about that rise of patriotism we've seen it also in polling in Alberta, right? People were very upset about the 51st state stuff, and when you frame things that way, you find that people in Alberta, Saskatchewan, and Manitoba as well are not that different from people in Ontario and Atlantic Canada and BC. When you get to the specifics, perhaps, talk about the relationship with Ottawa. Yeah, that can be different from one province to the next.
what a hopeful way to end our conversation. Look at this. Éric Grenier talking about everybody in this together. I would say what a treaty message that is. You're bringing in some real good Kanata messages there, some good let's all look after each other and create multiculturalism and democracy. And of course, and Indigenous peoples are always the ones that are like, hey, let's get sit at the table and let's share some food. And what do you mean you're bringing the SWAT team? These guys
Well, let's just try to get through the next 2.5 weeks.
That's without that. Yeah, that's a good hopeful message. Éric, big miigwech and thanks for your time.
Great to talk to you.
Now, Dan,
Yes.
tell me that wasn't the greatest interview you've ever heard in your life.
Well, typically I don't listen to my own interviews. So I will say this is the greatest interview you've ever done in your whole life. How's that?
You were doing so good until that moment, but
Now that we're family, I have to speak truth. Truth
it's
to family.
the
Truth to family.
power. Okay, fine. But I will say Éric Grenier knows everything and every one and every riding. It is amazing that he can just off the top of his head talk about who the winner was in, let's say, Alma Transcona, Churchill, Giwaid Nagoski. Like he can talk about what happened in 1985 at this moment in this riding in Northern Alberta. And I mean, it is his job, of course, but it is pretty impressive considering we are talking about 300 plus ridings across the country that he has basically stored into that brain.
Yeah, I will say too that, during an election campaign, frequently I receive notes from other national media saying, "Oh, hey, would you like to, come on and talk about the race in Manitoba?" And I usually either don't respond or, I sort of say, if you want to talk about the race in Manitoba, but yeah, that's great. But if you don't know anything about the race in Manitoba, I don't really want to talk to you.
I don't explain them.
Yeah, no, because but Eric understands politics in every province and region of the country, and that's why he's a gem.
He really is and very
Yeah, and
talented and
if you don't know about The Writ, which is a daily newsletter and a podcast, subscribe. Pay him a little money. You can subscribe and support the but honestly, if you want to understand how politics works in this country, that's the place to go to. That's the number one place. The number two place is Negan and the Lone Ranger. That's the number two place to go to understand politics in this country because we are so well connected, that we know Eric. We must be good. So
That's right. We surround ourselves with the right people. Speaking of right people, big thanks to everybody at the Free Press as usual for supporting us and for ensuring that we have not only this but our newsletters that are often up. And huge thanks to Wendy Sawatzky and of course, you know, our absent voice this week, Adam, our producer Adam, who great work over there at CJNU. If you haven't heard or listened to CJNU, it is the best music you could possibly listen to. Because it's community driven, it's volunteers that run that radio station. Adam is a fearless, hard worker, and please, you know, give CJNU a listen and support local radio. It's really brings you not only this podcast but also all the other great work that people do throughout our city, Winnipeg. Make sure that you support local journalism.
I'll be disappointed if because he's going to edit and and wrap all this up into a podcast when it drops. Like he produces the episodes. If we don't actually make him cry with that, it's I'll be disappointed if he doesn't cry.
There's that sound that you're hearing far off in the distance is Adam's ears.
I can't believe they love me. Could he be our podcast brother too?
No.
No. Okay. Okay, because I thought I need help. I need an extra set of hands to fix the fence, dude.
Okay, you can bring him on,
Okay.
but he's just a part-timer for
Okay.
now, so.
Well, thanks everybody for tuning in, and we will have one more episode for you before the big day. With the Easter weekend and everything, it works out. We'll have one more episode, and on that episode, this is I can tell you because you don't know this yet, but we're going to pull back our election prediction panel. We're going to handicap the election in Manitoba and Canada. And yeah, it's going to be great.
There's going to be numbers, it's going to be a board, and there's going to be lots of bells.
Less bells and woo, other sound effects. So, okay. Bye, everybody.